Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers. What makes successful authors tick? What does it take to sell that manuscript? Is self-publishing a good option? Or is selling your book to a big publishing house still the only way to fly? What about keeping up with your first big success? We'll talk about all this and more on today's show, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World, and PR Rules, The Playbook. Hello, and welcome to Authors Between the Covers. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, your host. We are thrilled to be here today with best-selling author Anita Diamond. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Before we get started, let me say to our listeners that if Anita's first mega hit, The Red Tent, isn't a book that you have read and devoured, then you must immediately add this title to your reading list. Published in 1997, it was her first work of fiction. It was inspired by a few lines from Genesis and became a word-of-mouth bestseller thanks to reader recommendations, book groups, and support from independent bookstores. In fact, in 2001, the Independent Booksellers Alliance honored The Red Tent as its BookSense Best Fiction Selection. Today, there are editions in more than 25 countries worldwide, from Australia, England, and Finland to Lithuania, Spain, and Sweden, which is an author's dream, but it's mostly a reader's dream because this book is just so fantastic. So my first question is, you started out as a freelance writer and you've written for the Boston Globe, Self, Parenting, McCall's, Ms., just the list goes on. So tell us a little bit about how you got from being a journalist to an author.
Well, I was working for actually the Boston Phoenix, which is now no longer with us. It was a weekly alternative paper here in Boston. And I was sort of itching to write a book, and I was looking for a topic, nonfiction. I was writing nonfiction. I like writing nonfiction. I was getting married, and I asked the rabbi who was marrying us what I should read, and he said, you should write a book about weddings because the books are really not good. So I looked at the books, and they were not helpful to me. So they were either written by Orthodox rabbis, which is not me, or they were etiquette books, and they were about matching yarmulkes and matchbooks. Remember the days when matchbooks were handed out at events. So I wasn't finding even the wonderful customs my rabbi was talking to us about, Rabbi Larry Kushner. So I thought, there's a book there. And so the year after my wedding, I wrote The New Jewish Wedding, and it's still in print. It was first printed, I think, in 1984. And it's been in print ever since.
So you've actually written 5 fiction books and 7 nonfiction books, including your latest book, which we're talking about today, The Boston Girl. I felt like I flipped through it because each word, the pages turn themselves. So it's destined to be another bestseller for sure. And it's a gripping story of a young Jewish woman growing up in early 20th century Boston. Publishers Weekly already said it's a stunning look into the past with a plucky heroine readers will cheer for. So tell us about this new book.
Well, the new book was actually inspired by a sign that I saw in Rockport, Massachusetts, which is a seaside, beautiful, very New England-y town about an hour north of Boston. And I've been vacationing there for a long time. There was an inn called the Rockport Lodge, which looked like all the other inns, except one day a friend of mine walked out the front door and I pulled my car over, and turned out she was a chef and she was working there for the summer. And she told me it was a women's only lodge that had been founded, I think early part of the 20th century. And it was very inexpensive and it was still in business. And so I was kind of fascinated by that. And then over the years I watched it kind of fall apart and ultimately close. And I was curious about it. So I started doing a little research and found out about this whole world of girls' clubs and settlement houses in Boston, and the idea of sort of social worker set helping immigrant girls and sort of young working women have a vacation, which would have not been part of their universe. Recreation was one of the values of the progressive era, so they were interested in giving girls that experience as well. So that was the setting, and I thought I would really write a book set in Rockport and Rockport Lodge. But Addie Baum, who's the heroine of the book, sort of came to the forefront more and more as I wrote, and I decided to make it her book. And she is a Boston girl, so that's kind of the genesis story of this one.
And she was born in 1900, and this story is just so great because she tells the story of her life to her 22-year-old granddaughter. And it's heart-wrenching when you read about how Addie's mom treated her, but it seems so stereotypical and perfect for the time because she really gave her a hard time. Publishers Weekly said, this plucky woman, super smart, she's chosen to read a poem in Paul Revere's Ride in front of a class, and it really sets her on a new path. So tell us more about the story.
Well, just to talk about her mother a little bit, this is a kind of classic immigrant story, Jewish, Italian, Irish. I mean, even today we have all these wonderful books coming from India and from Asia, and people coming from Africa as well, of generational, what happens when one generation who is not born in the country has American-born children. And there's always great tension between those two.
Tell us a little bit about Addie and who she was based on historical research you've done.
Addie is not based on any one individual, although there was, in fact, a settlement house like the one that is described in the book, and there was, in fact, a pottery in that building, and Rockport Lodge is a real place. So there are real settings in the book. Addie is the child of immigrants who really don't speak English. She goes to public school. She's very much an American in a way. Her parents don't speak English. She does. And she's sort of between those worlds until, in fact, at this reading club at a library, someone asks her to read a poem out loud, and she's sort of plucked into the world of the progressive era in a way. The woman who runs the settlement house sort of sees in her intelligence and her gumption, which is a word that gets used. And she's a mentor in a way, before we use the word mentor. And she helps her find her voice and sets her off on an independent path that she might not have found on her own. She might have ended up in a very low-paying and low-energy and non-intellectual job. But that's not what happens to her. She actually, because of the help that she got when she's 15, 16 years old, she ultimately finds her way to a kind of life that she kind of only dreamed about as a girl.
You know, I think it's a contemporary story as well. I could see myself in there where someone believes in you, someone doesn't, you gravitate to the people who do, and you're sort of following your own guts and instinct. It's such a beautiful story, and it's inspiring. Were you inspired by these characters as you were writing?
Yeah, I always like my characters very much, even the mean ones. I have compassion. There are very few characters in any of my novels who I really hate. There are a few, but not in this. Well, there was one boyfriend in this one who's pretty detestable, as you know. I certainly identify with Addie in a way. I'm the daughter of immigrants, but they moved to the United States in the late 40s. My mother grew up in Paris. They both spoke good English, so we're talking about a different universe. But there is a difference between someone who's American-born and parents who aren't. And I did have wonderful teachers and counselors and drama coaches and writing coaches and in my school, in my public school experience that set me off in directions here I am talking to you today.
Right. It's amazing. So tell us more about your background and your career. Did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
No, I wanted to be an actress. I wanted to be on Broadway singing and dancing and headlining, you know. And I actually did a lot of theater in high school and a little bit in college. But it was not a life that I was really willing to sacrifice for. I was always a big reader, so I decided to get a master's degree in comparative literature, actually. And then I decided I was not going to be an academic and moved to Boston, where I kind of stumbled into a journalism career and did a lot of learning on the job. I had some wonderful editors who taught me a lot, and started working for the Boston Phoenix in the 70s and wrote a column, first person, so I got to develop my own personal voice thanks to a wonderful editor who's still a friend, Andy Zellman. And I wrote feature stories, and so I got to explore the world. You know, you have great access as a feature writer, so I remember writing a piece about cloistered nuns, which is fascinating for someone who was Jewish. and they were terrific. And I wrote stories about the beginning of the AIDS epidemic and the doctors who were taking care of people. And I wrote about food. I was a generalist. And it was during that period when I wrote that first book, the wedding book. And then I had a baby, and there were really no books about rituals for welcoming a daughter into Judaism. And so I wrote that book, the New Jewish Baby book. And then I said, no more Jewish books. I don't want to be typecast. But that, you know, you should never say never. There were four more in the following years. So, and then I decided at some point in my 40s, I had been doing nonfiction for a long time, that I needed a challenge. So I thought I'd try writing a novel, and I borrowed a plot from the great storehouse of plots for the Western civilization, which is the Bible. And the story of Dina spoke to me because, first of all, she doesn't say anything, and that meant I could give her a voice. And also, I thought there was a kind of mystery surrounding what really happened to her. So what really happened to her, and that followed by terrible circumstances. We won't spoil this for anyone who hasn't read the book. And then I got very lucky, and it found its audience, and it did become a bestseller.
So what does it feel like to hit this kind of author stardom?
It's Cinderella. It's a very Cinderella feeling, and there's a sense of wonder and gratitude. I'm really glad this happened to me when I was in my 40s rather than in my 20s, because I'd already published books and had them, you know, they were published and then nothing happened. And so I was used to what happens really to a writer. So, and this built slowly also. It didn't happen, like, it was not an overnight success. As you said, I owe it very much to book groups and independent bookstores and personal recommendations. So it built slowly. But it's still sort of stupefying to me, not just how many have been sold, but how much the book means to readers.
Do you pick your titles, or do they pick you? Not necessarily the title of the book, but your subjects, what you're writing about.
They don't pick me. I don't, you know, they don't come to me in a dream or anything. The story, the novel ideas come from just all over the place. The Dina story was, in a weird way, a writing exercise. As I said, I wanted to try something different. I actually started by writing about Rachel and Leah, the mothers, but I had never written a novel before. I needed a plot, so Dina provided the plot. The second novel, which is contemporary, was in a funny way inspired by all the Madonnas in the bathtubs in Gloucester, Massachusetts. It's a very Catholic town, and on many people's lawns there are statues of the Madonna. Some of them literally in bathtubs, some of them, you know, in the sort of under an arch. And it was also a summer when it seemed to me a lot of my friends were being diagnosed with breast cancer. Like, every fifth phone call, I thought, this can't be. So I knew I wanted to write something totally different, so contemporary, much smaller cast of characters. So that came from there. Last Days of Dogtown, which is also set on Cape Ann, as is Good Harbor, happened because I was in a bookstore. I picked up a pamphlet about Dogtown, which is a part of Cape Ann, which is unsettled and wild. It's a park now, but it used to be the original settlement. So there were great names of characters in that pamphlet, and that inspired that book. Day After Night, which was set in a internment camp in Palestine right after World War II, that book happened because I was in Israel touring Atlit, which is the name of the internment camp, because my daughter was there on a semester high school program. And I heard this story about an escape from there in 1945, and I thought, oh, that's a novel. and the Boston Girl, as I told you, was driving along, and there's a friend of mine walking out of this inn, and this unlikely story that sent me off. She told me that's happened actually a long, long time ago, but it's always stayed in my mind as something I wanted to pursue. So as you see, they come from various places.
Yeah. So tell us, is the fiction more of a pull than the nonfiction? What do you like about each genre?
I find fiction much harder to write. Just, you have so many choices. I find nonfiction easier because it seems more contained. There's a number of facts I want to get across, a certain number of experts I want to talk to. And when I am hearing the same thing over and over again from the next expert, I realize I probably know enough to get started writing. But with fiction, you know, you can go left, you can go right. They can die, they can live, they can have children. So it's much more open-ended. But I enjoy doing both. I really do. I still occasionally write articles for here and there, and I hope to always do that.
And you've had tremendous critical success, including a new series on Lifetime TV. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Lifetime TV has created a miniseries based on The Red Tent. It's two nights. It's like about 4 hours, and it's airing December 7th and 8th. And I think it's at 9 on Eastern time, but check your local listings. I had nothing to do with the series, so I was not a consultant. I didn't have input in, nor did I really want to. I wanted somebody else to. I'm not a screenwriter, and since I wasn't going to have that kind of control, I didn't want to be in anybody's hair as they made their own piece of art out of it.
They needed to get your approval?
Well, they needed to buy the rights.
And have you seen it?
The funny thing is people have asked me if it's faithful to the original, to the book. And I just keep remembering when my book came out, I got a lot of criticism from certain quarters that I was not faithful to the Bible, right? But I was writing a novel. So the miniseries is different from the book in lots of ways. So it's not quite faithful to the story that I told. But it's faithful to my commitment to telling stories about strong women who are who have a lot of resilience, who depend upon support and love, and as well as the men in their lives. And it, you know, it's a celebration of women's strength. So to me, that's sort of the where the book, the miniseries and the book are very in line with each other, and that makes me very happy.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. I can't wait to watch it. So what are you working on now?
Oh, I'm talking to people on the phone about the miniseries and The Boston Girl. That's what I'm working on now. The Boston Girl goes on sale on December 9th, and I will start appearing in bookstores and talking to people about it. And I'm not going to start anything till, I don't know, maybe the springtime.
Well, excellent. Well, you'll have to keep us posted. And last but not least, tell us about your work with mayimchaim.org.
Mayimchaim is a ritual bath, a mikvah, which is an ancient Jewish custom of immersion in water, in living. Mayimchaim means living water, so the ocean is living water. It's water that hasn't been carried by human hands. So the water in our pools, they look like sort of very large hot tubs, and they're full of treated, heated city water. But there's a little bit of rainwater, which we collect from the sky, which sort of transforms it into living water. And people use it as a to mark transitions in their lives. So, for example, if you're becoming Jewish, immersing in a mikvah is the last ritual that you perform, and it marks the difference between your status as not Jewish to being Jewish. And you're still the same person, but you have a different status. So brides and grooms go before their weddings to mark the difference between the status of being unmarried and of married. The classic and traditional use for mikvah also, married women would use the mikvah after separating from their husbands during their menstrual cycle, and then you go to the mikvah, and then you can return to your marital relations, as they say. Our mikvah here is kind of a 21st century reinvention of the mikvah. All of those things happen at Mayimchaim. And people use the mikvah for other kinds of transitions in their lives. Everything from becoming a grandmother to getting your driver's license, from healing after a mastectomy to becoming a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah. So these are all moments of tremendous change in people's lives, and it's a way of it's a ritual of mindfulness to take the time to think about a major change in your life and to enact it by immersing naked in a pool of wonderfully warm, soft water. You do this privately on your own. Sometimes a witness is there if you wish. Your modesty is maintained. And we've been open, this is our 10th year, and was the founding board chair. And we've sort of redefined mikvah internationally thanks to our website. So we've been in touch with people all over the United States and all over the world. And that's Mayimchaim in a nutshell. And if you want to learn more, you can go online. It's Mayim Chaim, MayimHayim.org. There's video, there's all kinds of information.
Well, before we let you go, I love how you brought Jewish tradition to life again and the respect that you have for it. And as I'm Jewish as well, how has your Judaism evolved through these books?
The life cycle books, as I said, sort of followed me. So I got married and then I wrote the wedding book. I had a daughter and then I wrote the baby book. My husband converted to Judaism, so I wouldn't have written that without his experience, and I didn't write the book about death and dying until after I had lost my father. So it was a way of learning more about the experiences that I'd gone through, my friends and peers had gone through, and just sort of deepened my understanding of what's traditional and also of the great vitality of American Judaism, which continues to evolve and grow and change.
Oh, it's beautiful. Well, it's an inspiration and it's great guidebooks for all of us in terms of fiction and nonfiction. So I thank you on behalf of all of the readers out there for what you've done, and your work is just gorgeous.
Thank you.
We are talking to Anita Dommett, author of The Red Tent, and her latest, The Boston Girl, a novel coming out on December 9th, and also a new Lifetime series based on The Red Tent, December 7th and 8th. On Lifetime TV. Thank you so much for your time, Anita. We really appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Authors Between the Covers on the Incandescent Radio Network. Stay tuned for our next interesting author. We'll talk to you soon. That's it for today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. Be sure to check back next week on the Incandescent Radio Network for another interview with a successful author who is happy to share their story. Here's to writing your heart out and keeping your dreams alive. Thanks so much for listening.